Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 237, and it's a Halloween two-part special with a hell of a guest. You will already know who it is. I've been holding off. My Patreon crew will know who it is already because I told them a few weeks back. But yeah, I'm joined this week at long last by the one and only Liam Howlett for an incredibly rare, personal and in-depth two-part conversation. So yeah, I'm delighted that this one's come about. I mentioned Patreon there. I almost said who I'm collaborating with. Me and someone are releasing something today. I'm not going to tell you about it just yet because I promised the Patreon lot I'd give them a head start. So there's a good chance it'll sell out before anyone other than the Patreon lot know about it. So I'm giving you a warning there, but if you want to head over to patreon.com/scroobiouspip, it's less than a quid to join that gang and to get the heads up on these things. There's some other merch coming out soon in the winter that I'll give you a head start on as well. It's less limited, but yeah, I'm just saying today of all days, you might want to head over. Oh man, that seems harsh actually, because if you subscribe today, then I think you'll get charged again tomorrow because it's the first of the month. So yeah, that's confusing. But still, it's less than a pound a month. So if you enjoy these podcasts, less than a pound a month seems reasonable. Anyway, I'll stop rambling on about that. It's very exciting. But I will talk about last week's podcast, which went down an absolute treat. I've had some great ones recently. Sage Francis and B. Dolan were on last week, and I talk about B. Dolan I think in this episode at some point. Yeah, really pleased with the reaction there. People seemed hype for me to have them back on. They're obviously part of Speech Development Records, so if you head to speechdevelopmentrecords.com, you can buy their album, you can buy my merch, or you can buy Distraction Pieces merch, and so on and so forth. But yeah, sitting down with Liam, it was an absolute treat. If this is your first time tuning in, I know we've got a lot of new listeners because of Spotify. So if it's your first time tuning in on Spotify or on Acast or iTunes, then first of all, you know, welcome. Welcome, welcome. And secondly, yeah, you might want to go and check some of the back catalogue. Goldie feels like he might appeal to Prodigy fans. Roots Maneuver, maybe. Some Kate Tempest. Mike Skinner. We had Mike on. Professor Green, example, some really good people over the I've had Eddie Temple Morris on one of the early ones, and on towards the end of that, he tells amazing stories of being on tour with the Prodigy. So definitely check that out. But yeah, I won't ramble on too much because this is a two-parter. So enjoy part one. That's up now because you're listening to it. Part two will be up at midday. In the next part, I'll mention what the limited edition Halloween surprise is. Yeah, because they'll probably have all gone by then. Anyway, this is episode 237 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with the Prodigy's own Liam Howlett. So I always do a backup now because out of the 230 odd I've done, I had one that didn't get the file corrupted and it broke my heart. I managed to go back and re-record it, but I was just heartbroken. I felt like an idiot. I felt like an amateur. Just I was watching it the whole time, it all recorded, and then I had a 3-hour drive afterwards and I got to the hotel room and the file was 10 seconds long and I was like, what?
Oh, fuck.
Mate, so that was grim. But yeah. I'm here today with Liam Howlett. How you doing, man?
How you doing, man? Yeah, good. Yeah, I'm in good spirits.
It's been a long time coming, right?
Yeah.
We've been going back and forth on this for a while. Well, I'll get an email off you. It's been a good few years.
Yeah, man. Looking forward to it.
And every now and then I'll get a nice email if there's an episode that you've particularly enjoyed. And they'll be like, that'll be my point to go, you're still welcome anytime, man. But again, as we were saying before we started rolling, it's timing, isn't it? You've got a new record and a new tour and all that coming. That's the perfect time to have a proper conversation.
The thing with me is I'm a kind of, I used to be able to sort of multitask and put the mind to doing different things. But I find now if I'm doing a record, that's all I can do. Do you know what I mean? I can't even go out to dinner with my mates. Do you know what I mean? I kind of like literally come in here in the studio and just sitting here for like sometimes 18, 19 hours a day and loving it.
Yeah.
You know, and having a sleep on this couch when I need to.
Yeah,
you know?
And
that's the only way to get it done. And that's, I think, that's one of the reasons why this album was done so quick, this one I've just written, you know.
Yeah. It's a great space, man. The art on the walls.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It's kind of like an extension of my house, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. All the bits that my wife sort of says, nah, you're not putting that in the house, they end up in here.
It's too dark or moody or grim.
Yeah.
You bring it in here. That's perfect. So so how's it been this last? I mean, what you were saying there about getting that focus, I think that's a really important thing, and I think it's the thing that's getting overlooked in the music industry a bit now, because we've gone all digital and people are like, you don't need a label anymore. So, well, some artists need to just be the artist. They don't need to be worrying about every detail of a release or the build-up or the timing, all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
But sometimes you need other people there to go, well, here you go, let us deal with that and you deal with being...
Yeah, it's kind of like, leave me alone and I'll tell you when it's done. Yeah. I hate the, you know, there's nothing worse than like any kind of person that's record company based, whether sticking a timeline on something. But I mean, to be honest, all the pressure comes from myself, not really from anyone else. I don't really care about record labels and stuff, do you know what I mean? And I care about myself and the band when it comes to the music, us three, you know?
Yeah.
You know?
And it feels like you're enjoying being back in the cycle as such of touring, touring, recording. Because you obviously, you've had long periods off from that, and then it feels like you've come back, and often when bands come back, you're like, oh, is it going to be a one-off thing? But it seems like you've all found your role and your stride and gone, right, this is exciting now. I want to... You're playing huge tours and you want to play new music there as well.
It's the train you can't get off, really, but we don't want to, do you know what I mean? It's like, you know, every time we kind of... We always assess ourselves, say, have we got something to give? You know, do we enjoy it? Do you know what I mean? And it kind of like all feeds from the music. I mean, from the start, if I've got ideas that I feel strong, then it's kind of like, okay, there's four or five ideas, we're doing an album now.
Yeah,
we're doing an album when we're starting. Do you know what I mean? That's kind of the way it's always been, especially with this record, because I said to the guys, to Keith and Maxim, I said, I think I'm just going to do EPs, you know, because I like the idea of sort of getting sort of three or four tracks together, sticking them out, you know, going and doing some gigs, sticking another EP out, and it feels more like
immediacy of
exactly, man, and just kind of like more regular, do you know what I mean? And just, but then of course once I've started in the studio, I've gotten a really good buzz, and before long I'd got six ideas down pretty quickly, and then I'm like, I sort of rethought that idea and thought, I still am old school, I still like the idea of you know, stamping the authority of an album on 2018. Prodigy 7 albums. It's not many, is it? 7?
No.
It ain't many.
It's not. But again, we'll get into it.
Mm.
They've all had such important changes in them and developments along the way that it's exciting. I completely get the idea of EPs, because again, it's something I've thought along the lines of. If I come back to music, well, maybe an EP because it's got that immediacy, but if you're writing an album and having that immediacy, then that's fine. Yeah. If the album is done quick enough, because everyone, if you slave over an album, by the time it comes out, there's going to be songs that you're not excited about anymore.
Yeah.
Because you're excited about the stuff you've just done. And that's the double-edged sword of it.
Yeah. I must admit, I still quite like the idea of doing EPs in between the albums.
Yeah.
So when you've sort of done your singles or whatever, and you're in that point where you've done Michael Jackson, you released 10 tracks of singles. You know, you get to the point where the album's kind of done, and that's a good time to be doing it, because I'm writing all the time. You know, all the time I'm writing beats every day, because I love it still. It's not work to me, you know. I've always done that. If I've got a bit of spare time, that's what I do.
I was going to say, do you get to write on the road much?
All the time.
Because tours are, the monotony of tours is what kills bands. But if you're at that point where you've got that control and creativity.
The touring can breed kind of like a certain sort of craziness, I think, do you know what I mean? And some people can handle it, some people can't, do you know what I mean? It tends to reduce you to kind of like schoolboy behaviour, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And just, you know, sort of just to knock the boredom off and keep yourself entertained, do you know what I mean? But like,
it's not the real world, is it?
It ain't the real world.
It's a bizarre one, but it's just not the real world. It's
one story just come. I just said saying that one story just came back to my mind. Actually, we were in Japan. This is going back to It was in the '90s. It was late '90s, maybe 1998, 1999.
Yeah.
We're in Japan doing Fuji Rock Festival. The festival got rained off, and so all these bands are in this hotel. Us, Green Day, Rage Against the Machine, and we're drinking, you know, we're just like, going, what the fuck are we going to do, you know?
Yeah.
Can I swear on this?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, good. So the next thing we see is we get a knock on the door, and it's one of the Green Day boys they've gone out and bought these guns, these like ball bearing guns. So they chuck a couple of us, and then we just spend the rest of the night running around the hotel. And that's the kind of stuff you do, you know, just to kind of alleviate the boredom, really. But obviously, we live for that hour and 20 minutes, whatever it is. We try and get it like more like the Ramones, more like 50 minutes. Yeah, it has more impact.
Yeah.
But no, you know, you live for that moment on stage where you can play the tunes. That's what the Prodigy are built for.
Yeah, and the rest of it is filling time until you get there.
Like I said, I'm not a sightseer. I'm more of a nighttime person. I prefer just to kind of not. I don't really go outside during the daytime much. You know, I'm usually just traveling really if we're doing gigs. You know, but I'm not one to kind of. I've seen everything before. I'm not bothered about going to the Leaning Tower of Pisa and shit like that.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
You've done that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of. It's all about that moment on stage. Other than that, it's hotel rooms.
Yeah, which can be fucking boring, but like it's part of the job. But hey, that's what we love, you know. I mean, the Prodigy couldn't exist if it wasn't for the live side, you know.
Yeah,
I was thinking about it the other day. I was thinking, like, I'd still write music, but being able to play that music on stage influences what that is,
you know?
And sort of, I guess, you know, I'm not an angry person, I would say I'm sort of got some kind of gripe going on, but just I like tension in music,
and it
kind of. I think the stage is where it sort of manifests itself, really. Do you know what I mean?
Was that always in your music taste when you were growing up on that? Like, what was the music you grew up with? Because there is, I think the thing that I connected with is there always felt like a punk influence and a hip-hop influence. And that was the two genres that I grew up in love with. So.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm too young to have sort of bumped right into the sort of the 70s punk rock.
Yeah.
I was more two-tone, you know. This was going when I first got into music, when I was really young, you know. The two-tone thing was the thing I got into. And I think it was literally like my dad bought me a alarm clock radio. I must have just picked up the first cassette you saw.
Yeah.
It happened to be Dance Craze. It was a two-tone live album.
Right.
Basically, I just got into that. And just I just loved the specials, you know. And just remember just looking at the album cover and just thinking, yeah, man, I want to be in that gang. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And just, I just like the fact that it was sort of multiracial as well.
Yeah,
in a way,
do you know what I mean?
It was just really exciting and different, you know. And I think from pretty young age, I was, I kind of knew I wasn't into pop music. I could tell, you know.
Yeah.
I was into music that had a kind of force behind it, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I get you.
A bit of bollocks, you know.
Yeah, I love that. So how was that out in small town Essex? Because there's not going to be a burgeoning music scene. Also, growing up in Essex, I know in the 80s and 90s, it wasn't that multiracial either.
That's right.
Do you know what I mean? So that must have been a positive example to have that kind of tape to go, oh, right, this is a mixture. This isn't the white land that I live in.
And, of course, like when the two-tone when the two-tone thing exploded, it was about the fashion, you know, and you know, about the style, about the fashion, about the music. And, you know, obviously as a kid, you know, you bump into these, you know, these bands performed on Top of the Pops. So you could see like the beat, the Selector. And so it was, you're kind of drawn in by the style of it all and kind of the way they are, they're cool, you know.
Yeah.
And so, you know, at school, and I'm sure there's thousands of people that were trying to bend the rules, but like, you know, you'd see how far you can take the piss and go in with the Stay Press and the Fred Perry with a tie on, you know, and try and bend the rules to kind of do that. So that was kind of the first thing. And then when that sort of tapered off, a sort of electro appeared. And I just, I think when I heard Grandmaster Flash and the Wheels of Steel, that first tune, my friend was a DJ. He was just a sort of mobile DJ, and he played sort of jazz funk and Brothers Johnson and stuff like that. And then Grandmaster Flash released that tune. And it was like, I just thought, he's made that out of other people's tunes.
Yeah.
Cutting them up on the turntables. I could do that. Yeah. I just like the, then I started doing the pause button sort of stuff.
It's, mate, I've got a weird story about that. There's a guy at my club night who he's the best DJ I've had. He's a DMC champ. His name's DJ Destruction.
Yeah.
And he was on Mike Allen's LBC in a pause button mix contest against you. And he reckons that you came first and second, and he came third. He reckons that you were under two different names, but he was definitely, he was just second. Behind you. Yeah.
Yeah. I came first. Well, this is what happened. So I borrowed my mate, this is the DJ guy, I borrowed his four-track recorder, and I don't know why he had it, but I thought, well, I'm going to put it to use. I took it for a few days and just put together this little mix, and Mike Allen on, was it Capital? Capital Rap Show. He was having I think CJ McIntosh was going to be the judge of it. He was the DJ. He was the judge of the thing. And basically, like, it was like a three-minute mix, and I entered one mix under DJ Fame or something. And then I kind of thought, I don't know if I was really happy with that. And then so I entered another one under a different name, DJ ED. And, yeah, come first and third.
So amazing. Quite, so, yeah, he came second a place in there. So how was that, though, to get that kind of, to have radio allowing you that outlet, I guess? Because, again, I do believe in these small-town Essex type things. You need those things that allow you to go, oh, this could be a thing.
Yeah.
This is possible. It's not just...
Yeah. Yeah, man. I mean, that was the first thing that happened to me that... And this is all from a bedroom. And I was young still. I was like... how old was I? I must have been 15. I was still at school. I know that. Yeah, that, it was exciting, you know. And I kind of... I didn't really think much of more of it. But, like, I mean... Mike Allen still owes me a pair of Adidas trainers that never turned up.
I love that. So
I think he died, unfortunately. I think he passed away, actually.
Well, you have to inquire with the estate on these old trainers. But so what was the journey from Paul's Button of mixes in your bedroom to essentially putting a rocket under the rave scene with Charlie and...
Yeah, man.
With the and with XL, and obviously I've had Nick Hawks on the podcast, and I had Richard Russell produce a track on my solo record. So XL are just an amazing thing, but it kind of, they stumbled upon some gold there, you know, an exciting moment, an explosion.
They certainly didn't stumble on it. I stumbled into their office and forced it on them. Basically, like, I've kind of, this is what happened. I was into hip hop, and after going out a few times in London, well, lots of times, and just not really... you know, not really feeling it, and it was kind of a quite sort of a volatile sort of stage, and it was kind of like, I think Westwood, we were following Westwood around, and he did a gig in it might have been Lowestoft, I can't remember the exact thing, and after he set, it turned into like an acid house party,
right?
And I just stood there on the balcony, and my mates were like, we're gonna go, and I just thought, what is this, you know? I'm seeing something I've never seen before. It was like everyone's sort of communicating to each other on the dance floor. And it's gone from a kind of like a moodiness that was kind of always pretty heavy in the hip hop jazz, you know. And Essex was heavy, you know, without a doubt. You know, I mean, we'd spent all our youth all over Essex and into East London, and it was heavy, you know. But then I saw like I just heard sort of like these DJs were mixing kind of like the beats with this kind of new type of music, you know, I'd never heard before. It's kind of acid house music. But it was the feel I got from it. It was I guess it was going back to the sound system culture. It was the bass, you know. And I was, from that moment, I was hooked. So I spent all 1990 basically just writing and going out. And I think I went to XL with a demo tape. I phoned Nick up and said, I've got a demo. Yeah, post it. No, I'm coming down. So I just drove down there.
Amazing.
Car full of the lads, you know, and drove down there, and basically said, "Bosh, there it is," you know. listened to it, and I sat there while we listened to it. And then I forgot about it, went back home. I was working as a junior artist in a design studio,
oh, wow.
Payphone on the wall, yeah. And it rang 2 weeks later, and it was Nick saying, yeah, we want to offer you a deal. So basically that was how the whole thing started. So that at that point I was going out with Keith and Leroy. We were raving. We were just going out to the raves. All the
I was going to say, what was the Prodigy at that point?
Not at that point, nothing, because we were just friends.
Yeah.
And then we'd sort of go out every Friday to this place called the Essex Barn, and all the big DJs came through there, Frankie Bones, you know, Lenny D., Mr. C was there every week. I mean, it was at one point, it was one of the top clubs in the country. It was a great place. And it also had, like, Damsky played there live, you know, all the sort of big, I guess you could call them PAs, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Enjoy. You know, we were sitting there, and I was friends with Keith, you know, and I think he'd heard some of my demos and stuff. And he was like, I think it was Leroy's idea to get the band together.
Yeah.
He just said, we could do better than that. Why don't we do it? And I was like, yeah, let's do it.
I love the motivation of live gigs like that. Again, I remember it was a weird one for me. In the same week, I saw the Beastie Boys when they had their circular stage. I think it was at Wembley.
Round, yeah.
And I saw the Bloodhound Gang. And both of them, again, at no point was I saying I can do better than that. But I was like, it looked achievable. It was the first thing I'd been to. Because growing up in punk and that, and I played a bit of guitar, but wasn't very good and all that. Every band, it kind of felt, oh no, that's beyond me. And again, like working class Essex, you need all this equipment, you need this and that. They were the first ones I saw, and I was like, we could, like, with the greatest respect in the world, we could do something like that at the very least. And that's a huge motivation.
In that way, it's really DIY, and that's what drew me towards it. I was the same as you. There was no access into music with a guitar.
Yeah.
So you've got to learn to play guitar for so many years, and I was lazy, you know, I just kind of like, I like the immediacy of like, just this kind of making something out of nothing, you know, looping a beat, do you know what I mean? That was my entry point into that. And so the kind of rave, the East London breakbeat rave, that raw pirate radio sound, that's the shit I honed in on. That's the stuff I really loved. And Shut Up and Dance were the first people that started that whole movement, do you know what I mean? I've got to send respect to them guys, you know. There was lots of early records that were knocking about, you know, DJ Hype was on the scene, and all these dudes were kind of making this music that kind of connected the dots between what I was doing before and the early rave stuff, you know. So that was the first gig we played, was in Four Aces in Hackney, real sort of underground, run down old theatre. I think it was an old reggae venue from the 80s, you know, they used to put sound systems in there and stuff.
Yeah.
And then Friday night, it turned into like this kind of this madhouse, just strobes and kind of just full on,
just mayhem.
We played that. That was the first gig, and then the guy Joe, he asked us back to play the Saturday.
Yeah.
So then we're off. We haven't stopped since, literally.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. I mean, immediacy seemed like a key word there, because it was as soon as this started, it seemed to go absolutely mental. And I remember I used to take the chart shows off the radio and listen to it on my Walkman as I was doing my paper round. I delivered the Yellow Advertiser. And I remember clearly the excitement of hearing everybody in the place in the charts. And I believe it got to number two, and it was only because Freddie Mercury had just died and they re-released Bohemian Rhapsody that kept off the number one spot. But it was that time that it seemed all of a sudden there was music that I'd never heard on chart shows before. I wouldn't have had access to as a younger kid. I'm a few years younger than you. As that young kid, I didn't have an option of going and finding this stuff. So, whilst the charts aren't the be all and end all in those days, it was a fucking powerful a vessel for getting the music out there to people who wouldn't have been able to find it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was the fans that put it there.
Yeah.
They brought the records. You know, I mean, we furiously declined everything.
Yes.
We were ravers, you know. Being in the charts is the last thing we want to do. We were underground, do you know what I mean? We want to stay connected to that. So
it's the punk rock outlook, isn't it? Almost discredits you to do well. It's a bizarre one.
It is weird. A lot of bands do struggle with that. I mean, you try and just stick to your guns, and as long as you can have some kind of integrity, keep that intact. It's like, that's basically the way it's got to be, you know. But we rolled on with that, and it was great that people supported us, but, you know, the sort of chart positions and stuff were great, but we weren't really basing everything on that. We were, like, happy we were playing at the parties we were going to.
Yeah.
Like Raindance, you know, we'd go there. That was East London. And we were like, well, if we could play this, we would have made it, you know.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden we were there. Berwick Manor, you know, we played that. You know, all these great places. And I think culturally it's really important, the rave culture, you know, it's really significant, I think, you know.
So how was it? Because, again, the rave culture isn't necessarily a culture that was known at the time for albums. And you guys put an album together. And it was, again, I remember my older brother getting experience and Outer Space and Jericho and Rough in the Jungle. Yeah. So not only the singles, it felt like an album. Yeah. It felt like a body of work and a sound.
Well, I didn't want to do an album. And Nick, who put XL together, he kept saying, you should do an album, you should do an album. And, you know, we didn't want to do an album because it's...
You wanted to party.
Yeah, well, we wanted to do parties. You know, DJ 12s, it was all about the 12s, you know. It's kind of like almost releasing an album is kind of making us more normal, do you know what I mean?
I
rebelled against it for ages, and then we kindly thought, okay, you know, maybe it would be good to do, but one thing I wasn't going to do is just put all the singles on. I think I remixed every track, you know, so when Charlie was on there, it was a different version, you know, and so all the singles were different versions. They were just all new mixes, you know.
Yeah.
So I felt it was a bit cheap to kind of give people stuff they've already heard.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Here's this, but all in one place. Yeah. So, all right, cheers, I got that.
Yeah, yeah.
At what point, this is a unique conversation to us, because the last time I saw you was at our mutual, it's probably how we met, I guess, originally, was through Dave Clark, who was your accountant, and his son Matt is my accountant, and Dave, both of them were involved with you guys for so long.
Yeah.
And at the funeral of Dave, it was kind of said how he kind of an accountant. It sounds like a small thing. It sounds like the guy is just putting the numbers together. But it did feel like he had a greater impact. That he kind of came to you guys and helped you become a business as such, like what you went on to be, rather than just some kids who were there to have some fun and make some music.
Dave was more. He was a great friend of ours, you know. And basically, like, none of us really knew what we were doing.
No,
you know. And I think Dave obviously was the person that probably knew the most what he was doing.
Yeah.
But we've always had, like, a great team around us. And, you know, my manager, Mike, you know, he's with a combination of Mike, Dave, and you know, the people around us have had the same ethic as we did. You know, this kind of, fuck you, you know, this is, we're doing it this way.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not really a record company guy. So I've been in meetings with Dave where he's stood up for me, and it's great to have someone that speaks the same language, you whatever the job is, and if they're on your side and they're speaking the same language, they've got your back.
Yeah,
that means a lot to
me. And
that's
absolutely key when the people on the business side of it are as fuck you as you are. If they're like, what, that's not what you want. It might be good business, it might be good money, but that's not the Prodigy, that's not Liam, that's not Keith, that's, you know, so we'll back you on that. It never felt as if there was, it seems that you picked a team really well, that they weren't necessarily ever going, I know you don't want to do this, but you probably should. It's like, no, we'll do it how we do it.
Yeah, I mean, all the business stuff really was, it was just taken care of, you know. I mean, we never really, it wasn't really any, really a plan as such, you know. I mean, it's kind of like, oh, well, I've got to pay tax, have I? When? Well, exactly. No, you owe a load of money now, okay. You know, so it's like, it was a bit like that. You know, we, none of us really, I mean, I was working as like that office junior, I said, you know.
Yeah.
I think Keith was travelling around, Leroy was doing a bit of work here and there. And so we kind of, it was the first proper job we've had.
First
regular income doing the band. And it wasn't really, it's not a job, you know. I mean, it's kind of like, it never once has felt like a job to me, you know, being in this band.
Yeah.
You know, it shouldn't ever, you know.
I love that.
So it's kind of like, yeah, when you talk about the business side, I've never really thought about it like that.
Yeah.
I just thought Dave is my friend.
Yeah. And he's looking after shit.
Yeah, and he's great, you know, and it's that's the kind of people you want around you.
It's key, man, because, again, Matt has been the exact same for me, and just, he's meant I've not got in trouble numerous times, because I don't think about any of that shit. I don't know about what tax. I just know that he'll make sure the money's there to pay the tax man, and it'll all be legit, and it'll all be fine. Otherwise, I'd get in trouble through ignorance rather than through being dodgy or snidey or anything else.
When you've got three lunatics in the band, you don't want your accountants off their tits, do you? You know, exactly. You need them to be on the ball. So, exactly. You know, I think we chose the right people there and, yeah.
So because of the time of it and because of it, experience and all that being so out there, but then instantly came into Connect, a lot of people must have thought it was a flash in the pan, that this is some kids just playing some music and it'll be gone as quickly as it came.
Yeah.
So how did it feel then to come out with Jilted and, again, it be a respected, artistically, you know, Mercury-nominated, all this kind of thing? This, again, another complete album and an evolution of the sound as well.
Yeah. Everything in the band has always happened naturally. Nothing is... We've always gone with our gut feeling, tried to stick to what we all believe, you know. And I think what happened was, I was on stage at some rave in Scotland and I just thought, I'm not into this anymore. Mm. This isn't doing it for me. This isn't what it was,
yeah.
You know. And I don't know what this is, but it ain't me. Do you know what I mean? It lost its kind of ferocious kind of raw energy, you know.
Yeah.
It just was a bit toy town. Do you know what I mean? So I just thought, I've had enough now.
So important to have that honesty with yourself. Yeah, because, again, if things are going well, it's easy to go, they're going well. Even if it's dying a bit for you, you can go, they're going well.
Yeah, I know, man. That's
here's what they want. I can make more of this, you know.
But because it's such a big part of your life, you kind of think, you know, is it a matter of stopping this band and starting a new one or what? But basically what happened next was we went to LA. I think we were doing probably the last video of Experience, which must have been Wind It Up, I think it was. And Rage Against the Machine's first album come out.
Yeah.
And I remember we bought that and I think The Chronic was out as well at the same time. And we just played that solid for a week while we were there. And I came back just like, I think as well going to that trip to LA, you know, we did a lot of stuff that week, you know, just saw a lot of stuff. And it just really opened my eyes. And I think it was just a moment in time when I just flipped. Do you know what I mean? The mind had just opened to something else, you know.
Yeah.
And I saw another way forward for us. And the rave scene had kind of like practically gone, you know, and you got this criminal justice bill thing happening.
Yeah, of course.
And that kind of spurred on a kind of certain energy to write these new songs.
Yeah.
And I mean, I see it as a smooth transition. Some other people will look at the first and second album as kind of like completely different.
Yeah.
But when I look back now, I can kind of see it's transition. Maybe it's because I was inside it.
Of course.
Yeah, I remember every track on that album was kind of rebelling against something.
Yeah,
you know, it would be like, you know, Poison. Everyone was trying to write faster music. You know, the drum and bass, the jungle music was getting ridiculous. It was touching 180 BPM and stuff like that. And so I thought, right, just let's bring the hip hop back. And so that track was really, I was really happy, proud of that track when we did that. And as well, that was Maxim's first time he got on the mic and laid the vocals down.
Yeah, of course.
So that instantly felt like, right, we've got something that's a bit different here now.
Yeah.
We can keep what we had before, but we can retain that, but we can do this. And what we actually did, we went back to playing rock and roll venues. We played the Marquee. We went to unis and just started from ground 1-0.
Yeah.
On the live side again.
Yeah.
You know, and people just came to see us. And again,
it's beautiful there. You've got on the wall there, fuck this and fuck that, you know, a Johnny Rotten at his best.
Yeah.
And the thing that was key about the punk era at that time was that it wasn't just about, let's get our anger out by playing as fast as possible. Every time I put on a Pistols album or Clash, half their stuff, it's slower than I remember
controlled.
It. It's slower than I remember it. Exactly that. It's that controlled anger.
Yeah.
And that's an important thing there, that the rave scene was at a point where it was like, right, we need to just go faster. We need to go faster. And someone turned around and went, no, we need to go harder. It's not about faster. It's about going harder. And that's what you guys did. You kind of came out. And it was at that point as well that, whilst you'd done videos previously, it felt with Jilted, you started to find your look and your style and the direction that you were going to go in, with that No Good being just this beast of a video, just dark and grimy exciting.
I would say we were talking about the two-tone culture earlier, which, you know, the style of that and how smart people used to look. Obviously, that was really connected to fashion and style.
Yeah.
It wasn't particularly any fashion and style connected to the rave era as such, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
any,
yeah.
Or any particular style as such. So obviously, like at that time, we just rolled around in baggy tracksuit bottoms and weren't... But when the second album, you know, because I think it is important how you look. You know, any band wants to try and look something, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's really important. I don't understand bands who can't be bothered with album sleeves or artwork and they're not into the whole thing of it. I think he's, you know, he's all important. Do you know
it's,
what I mean?
It's really important. It's all part of that initial impact. Yeah, I always remember chatting with Sage Francis and B. Dolan when they were over, and they were saying that they, a few guys on Strange Famous on their label in America, they'd kind of taken aside and said, your live performance is great, but you're walking on stage wrong. And that sounds really small and stupid, but that's a massive part of it. That first view of you, that first impact is a huge thing. So if you're just kind of slumping out there, it's like, no, you need to be, you need to know how the show's starting, because it is all of that. And equally, an album cover can set the tone for how you hear that record.
Absolutely.
If you're looking at it and like, oh, this feels exciting or it feels dangerous, then you've started the job there, you know?
Yeah, I agree with you, man. I mean, moving forwards quickly to when I wrote Invaders album, which was three albums back now.
Yeah.
We had the cover really early on.
Yeah.
And I just put that on the wall. And just that image of that sort of airship thing was like some kind of spaceship landing. It helped with the music, you know, just to be able to look at that image and kind of soundtrack it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, completely.
And so, yeah, I know what you're saying with that. I mean, with Jilted, it was... It's not one of my favourite covers. I kind of look back at it now and I guess you're always a bit kind of... It's easy to sort of look back and stuff and pick it apart.
I do it all the time. I posted all our album covers the other day, and our second album, I was like, I loved it at the time, but it does nothing for me now. It's got no... Everything else, it tells me something about that time. That one, it felt like we've gone, oh, we're a professional band now. We need to have a professional-looking album cover.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, all right, well... What does that mean?
Yeah. No, I know.
So how was it? I mean, you spoke about the kind of the transition and the build and you feeling it was a natural transition rather than anything jarring.
Absolutely.
Going on to the next album, you started to build a band and you started to build a live band and all that kind of thing.
Kind of started at Jilted, really, because I'd recorded some guitars and was experimenting with bringing those into the set and kind of type of thing. And so, first of all, we had the guitarist. We wasn't sure whether we liked it or not, do you know what I mean? But we eventually liked it when we got it right. I think it was a hard thing to get right at the beginning. But
I went to my mate's band, Serious Problem, and grabbed their guitarist at some point for some level of time. And I remember it being all the hype around our area of like, it's going to join the Prodigy. Like this is huge thing. I know Stu Whiffen, who was the front man of Serious Problem, I think it is Richard.
Yeah, he was a good guy. Yeah, we tried loads of people out.
In Serious Problem, he dressed up as like a priest or some shit, and it was just had this like this over the top look. But yeah,
great. Yeah,
but how was that to kind of
you got his number?
Yeah, like how was that to put things together and to move things about and go? Because again, it's one thing starting a band when there's no eyes on you. I was talking about this to a mate of mine, Polar Bear, the other day. I was saying, if I ever come back to playing live, it'll take a lot of practice because I felt I got good. And generally, you get to be shit at the period when no one's looking at you. Like when you've got audiences of four or five people, that's when you get to be shit. By the time you've got thousands, you've been doing it a long time, you've got really fucking good.
Yeah.
How was that? Because you're having to put that together when you've already got eyes on you and you don't know how it's going to be yet. You've not added a drummer or a guitarist or whatever else.
Well, we added... The way we did the drums was we always knew we weren't going to use the drummer as a normal band uses a drummer.
Yeah.
Because the power of the music and the foundation of the music is the drums and the bass from the Prodigy, you know. That has to come from me.
Yeah.
You know, so... The way we'd integrated the drummer into the set, I mean, this might sound a bit boring, but like basically, you know, we'd EQ the bottom out of the drum kit, so you get the high end excitement in the snare.
Right.
So
yeah.
All the bottom end comes from me, the bass.
That's perfect.
And we just found a pocket where it just works, and gave it a live feel. So when he's playing to the is played into the click and the drum machine, it kind of just adds the extra thing on top. And we've experimented lots of ways to play this music live, and I think we all agree we finally found the perfect way to do it in around, it might sound crazy, in around 2005.
Right, it was that far in.
Yeah. So I think the technology wasn't there for us to be able to... to be able to just change things up really quick and just go to, like... Because, you know, electronic music can be quite limiting. You know, machines always break down and... Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like we went through a stage doing gigs where every gig something broke down and we ended up having to sell all the equipment and just get new stuff. I don't know what happened there.
And for live as well, because starting off electronic, it's not about the people who are playing it. It's about the room. It's about everyone you're vibing off there. And then you suddenly start to become this this band, particularly, as I said, particularly more Fat of the Land era, where it felt like it was now. But you've had Firestarter and you've had Keith explode into Keith, you know, so it is now, it's not, you can't be that kind of, oh, we'll just play and you dance. It's like, no, man,
it was a natural progression into that. And also I think people would like to sort of put you in the pigeonhole, so they like to be able to know what you're a band, if people thought of us somewhere in between sort of what Public Enemy do.
Yeah.
Like, as in the way their setup is with, it's halfway in between that and a guitar band.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, do you see what I'm saying? It's kind of that
completely.
Kind of philosophy, because that's where I come from, you know?
Yeah.
So, but going back to Keith, I mean, sometimes the band is led by me, like, and my actions and songs and stuff. And, you know, Poison was led by Maxim. He went, I'm doing vocals on this track. So it was him that pushed at that particular moment. And I probably haven't talked about this much, actually, but it was Keith that made the whole Firestarter thing happen.
Yeah.
You know, I backed him up.
Yeah.
He had the foresight and he said, the guy with long hair, he's gone. I'm the same guy, but now I can really express myself because now I've got a mic.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, I'm with you, brother, whatever you want to do, you know. And we didn't know what was going to happen. You know, I wrote Firestarter as an instrumental on first track. I just thought it was going to be the first track on Fat of the Land, instrumental. Comes into studio and he goes, yeah, I'm gonna write a description about myself. I was like, let's do it. And, you know, we'd written it in half an hour. But there was many more lyrics on the demo. And then sort of I'd listen to it over and over again the next couple of days and stripped them all out, got the right amount of vocals and stuff. And then I remember going to the strong rooms because we were going to record the music and the vocals all again in the big studio. And we got to the studio and they just couldn't get the music sounding like I had it.
Right.
Because I really, like, by that time I was really into production.
And
mastered the sound, you know.
Yeah.
And they, you know, whoever was doing it, they just, we were like, let's use the demo.
Amazing. And I love that.
The demo is what's out there and the vocals we recorded, and we tried Keith in a vocal booth and that was shit. So we ended up SM58 next to the mixing desk screaming into the mic, and that's how it happened.
That's beautiful.
It's great, man. I love the fact that it naturally stripped itself back down to to nothing. We'd spent, you know, $2,000 in this studio, but it naturally came back down to a 50 quid mic.
I love that. I did,
on a lead,
On my first ever record on No Commercial Breaks, which was the first time I'd got to be in a real studio and all that, and I could only afford 3 days.
Yeah.
So we recorded it all in 3 days. And it was exactly the same. There was a track there that it didn't have the rawness of the demo that I'd recorded in my mum's bedroom with mattresses up and a towel over the top and all this. And I ended up just going back to that because I was like, at points, or on good speakers, it's almost unlistenable because it's such low quality. But it's like that; it's got that energy, right? Like it's got it there,
it's got like a cassette quality.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, that was Firestarter, and I remember driving home from Strongroom back to Essex, and me and Keith, and just the feeling of two best mates creating something. You just know can't be touched.
Do you know what I mean?
We didn't know, give a fuck, whether it was going to be single or whatever it was going to be. We didn't know anything about that.
Yeah.
All we knew was, put it on again. put it on again. Oh yeah, man. We just nailed it. And that's a great feeling to have because,
Amazing.
Writing music, that's the feeling I look for myself when I'm writing music in the studio anyway. But to have that with, I had it with Maxim when we did Poison, and then to have it with Keith again with that, like that. So that was great, a great feeling.
That's it. I was going to say, like, how is that when you've been the leader and your mates are stepping up for the first time and you're supporting them, but then they fucking knock it out the park? Like, how rewarding is that? Because, again, there must be a level of, well, you know, I'll back you, but it may or may not work. Like, yeah, you don't know until that point. Poison is a prime example of that, he just stepped up and made a Stone Cold classic.
We never doubted ourselves ever because we knew it would work, you know, because it's like we write the rules, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, I remember the first time we played it on stage, and it wasn't the first time, but I remember playing it at Brixton probably within the first three or four gigs.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, literally, I remember Keith thinking, fuck, what are the lyrics? I can't remember the lyrics. You know, because his mind had just gone into what the fuck at that point.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it. And the track finished and it was like deadly silence. It was like, and then, you know, just, and then I just thought, yeah, man, this track's got this. It's got the fire. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Live, if it works live, then you just, because we love the tune.
Yeah. And but it's seeing if it's got that energy with the crowd.
People going to accept Keith on the mic.
Yeah, they
loved it. And it was kind of like a natural progression that Keith had got that mic and basically just, it was just an extension of him, another side of Keith.
Yeah.
An extra bit of him, you know.
And seeing that energy translated into the crowd, right? So you're suddenly not just got the rave crowd, you've got people moshing and going nuts. I got kicked out twice of the Prodigy All Nighter at Brixton because I got kicked out for going too mental for crowd surfing too much. And then I broke back in.
Yeah.
I went back to the door and I said, I've got my ticket for my coat. And they're like, well, you've been kicked out. I was like, look, it's just up there. And I walked in, and the way Brixton is, the cloakroom's up the big stairs. Yeah. I put one foot on the step. I looked round at them and then just ran through the big doors and back into the crowd. And then later on, I was like,
great.
Out there again about 10 minutes later because it had that energy. I don't know. I've no idea on that. I've got a few I've noted on. Yeah. I want to talk about, I was at V97 and I was at Red in 98, and both of them were huge. But yeah.
Brixton is a academy, is a sort of spiritual home, if you like.
Yeah.
I think the guy told us we played it the most times out of any band, which we were proud of. It might mean anything to anyone else, but we like that, you know.
Yeah,
it's like,
really?
Well, that's a nice little statistic in the book. No, but so that kind of really opened everything up. But I think we saw a change in the crowd from when we did Jilted, because when we did that album, the second album, we had the opportunity, and again, going back to like the people you work with, we've got this great few people that are like-minded as us, you know, taking risks. Where can we play? You know, what kind of countries can we play in? And we basically ended up doing a rock festival. And you've got to remember at that time, the electronic music was so far away from like a rock band. So it was
100%.
Helmet, Suicidal Tendencies, Biohazard.
And that was an era where you didn't cross over either. No. It was, you loved metal, you hated electronic.
Absolutely.
It was rivalry.
Metal, they don't like anything else, usually.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And this was in, it was Holt Thread Festival, I believe. And, we went on stage and it was hardcore, but we played it and afterwards we felt like we got respect.
Yeah.
And, you know, I stayed friends with Evan from Biohazard from that day.
Yeah.
He's a good fellow. And basically, like, we just thought, this is... We're going to do this. We're going to do it this way. So again, it was just always a natural progression. It wasn't ever, we just landed with Firestarter and, oh, well, what the fuck can we do? It's number one. What are we doing? It was a gradual build all the time. It was constantly building. When you're in it, you don't really get chance to kind of analyse it and pat yourself on the back or, you know, we're just constantly working all the time.
Yeah.
I wasn't home much.
And that's it. I mean, I think you do, you write your own story in a lot of these things. I remember I was on tour, the first time I was touring my solo stuff with my live band, and I had a track with Travis Barker and Danny Lonner from Nine Inch Nails, all this kind of thing. And it was the first time that we were doing that live, and the first night of the tour was in Hull, and it was in like an arts centre, and there was a power cut, and everything, it was still cool. I did some spoken word, all that, but it was still cool, but it went wrong. And I came off stage and B Dolan, who was supporting us, had tweeted saying, "That's the first time I've seen a mosh pit at a hip hop gig." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" He's like, "We've got the rest of the tour to do." Yeah. The next night, yeah. Mosh pit. Every night of the tour, yeah. Mosh pit. It hadn't happened in Hull. But again, he wrote that own story. And that's what it felt like with the No Good Start the Dance video. You had this dark, almost aggressive scene rather than the happy rave scene that you'd seen previously.
Yeah, man.
And that wrote itself. It then meant that everyone was going to these gigs and it was darker and it was grimier and it was...
Those videos, those early videos, you know, the ones that from sort of Jilted onwards were... They were good. We had a good run of videos. I mean, the thing with videos, I've said it before, is that you do have to put your trust and into someone else, you know, making this thing, this visual connection for, and you do your best to, you know, to talk to the director and kind of put the idea, understand what he's doing and try and say, is that right? And put some of yourself in it. But it is the one area that I don't really like, you know, because it's kind of, I guess I am a control freak. I realise that now. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, basically, you have to really take a bit of a leap of faith. And we've been to like 5 videos because I didn't like them.
Oh, really?
And they were expensive videos back then. And it's like, nah. There was the Firestarter video. There was one before.
Because that went off. That was
the second video we made for it.
Oh, really?
Black and white one. And the reason why it's black and white is because we spent all the money on the first one, which is shit.
So that's basically, mind-blowing.
I met a director in Europe, like I think it was the MTV awards ceremony or something, and I kind of liked what he did, and so we got him to do the Firestarter video, and he delivered it, and I was like, nah, man, this is not, that isn't capturing what Keith has created.
Yeah.
You know? And so we shelved it, you know, it was like 100 grand or something, and went back to XL and said, listen, forget about that video. I said, we won't have a video.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, we need a video. So I basically, I spoke to Walter, who had made the No Good video, Poison, Voodoo People, all those great videos. I rang him up and said, shit, man, I said, I need your help here. You know, I said, we haven't got any money, but, you know, can you help us out and do this video? And it's just the fact that he was so creative. I remember driving to the shoot, it's black and white because we spent all the budget.
Yeah.
And we're on the way. This is typical of us, though, because everything happens spontaneously. Like, Keith's like, whoa, stop the car. Pulled over, ran into a shop, come out with the Stars and Stripes jumper, put it on the way to the video shoot. You know, and then, that's, you know, mad. Basically you're like, where the fuck are we going? He's like, oh, yeah, we've managed to get into, like, Aldwych tube station, disused station.
Yeah.
Went down there and just, yeah, it was just, I mean, that was another good moment, because, you know, when you're doing videos, and I don't particularly like doing them, but Keith made that video. You know, he is his energy and his sort of belief in himself, which, like I say, for various parts of the band, all three of us have stepped up, which is great, I think, you know.
Yeah, completely. And again, it caused a stir. It had people saying it was scary, that they didn't want it on TV, that it was scaring their kids and stuff like that.
People just don't know how to express themselves. So
that's got to be music to your ears. Although, right, when Wally's are getting fired up over something, you know that's just going to be like, right, we're doing something right. We're doing something that's pushing it.
Yeah, I don't even think you think like that. You just think, yeah, whatever, you know, and you get on with it. You know, I don't remember really having any thought or listening to what other people had to say about it, because we were we were so on what we were doing and sure of the way we were doing it that we never really listened to it. We didn't really listen to the record company, you know. But Richard from XL was always great. You know, I mean, Nick had left XL, I believe, after the first album.
Yeah.
He'd started another label. When Richard took over, you know, me and Rich were really tight. He's a great guy. And what I like about Richard is he takes risks. You know, he was almost like another member of the band. We respected him. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he was like, yeah, of course we're fucking going to do that. That's what we're going to do, you know. And it's like, without any, just ballsy risks. And like, those are the types of people we like to work with. And, you know, basically, great. It just, that was fat of the land. But the funny thing was, Firestarter came out, I believe, was it 96? It was a, I think it was 96, possibly 95, I can't remember actually. But it was a year later that the album came out. So it was a whole year.
Yeah.
Which is crazy, really.
Yeah, it's mad to have this big single and not immediately go, oh, we need to follow it up. Quick, nothing.
Not even another single. It was literally like Breathe. We were playing Breathe live.
Yeah.
And Richard said, I reckon that could be a good single, that, you know. And so, again, we weren't even thinking about it. It was just another track we were playing live. And then eventually, you know, that came out, and then you were into Fat of the Land, and that's when it really fucking went mad.
Yeah,
yeah. That was really chaos from there onwards, really. Those, like, that back end of the 90s, it was just like, we didn't stop, man. Do you know what I mean? And we headed into serious burnout. End of 99, rolling into 2000, I think we'd all had enough.
Well, that was it. For me as a fan, I saw you at V97, and again, that was just a field full of people losing their shit. It was really just...
It was just like an electrical storm happening.
Yeah. It was all just the energy of nature and of the band and of the crowd was just all at one.
We felt as well with that gig. I mean, I've lived in London for years now, but we felt that it was kind of like a homecoming gig in a way. Do you know what I mean? So we owned it.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, it was a... That was a great gig. I won't forget that. You know?
Yeah. So, I mean, we spoke just now of ignoring what other people think and what other people say. And one of the other gigs I saw you at was a Red in 98.
Yeah.
And that was where the Beastie Boys had requested that you didn't play Smack My Bitch Up.
Sure.
And Maxim came on the mic like a monster and kind of, you know, yeah, it was all expressed that you do what you want kind of thing.
Yeah.
How was that? How discussed was that beforehand? How in the moment was that? How much consideration was given?
We had a little off with them backstage.
Yeah.
No fists, just a big row.
Yeah.
Ad Rock rang me. I mean, this story is old now, isn't it? Everyone probably knows. But, you know, Ad Rock rang me at my house the night before.
Right.
And I was like, first of all, how'd you get my number?
Yeah.
And we're talking about a guy who I respect, you know. I was into the Beastie Boys, so it's kind of a weird phone call to be having.
Yeah,
because I'm reassessing what are you about?
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I know
yeah,
what I'm about.
Yeah,
what
yeah.
are you about?
Yeah.
And why are you telling me what I can do? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it was a kind of weird. Yeah, it's a very unusual sort of situation to be in, really. And I knew once I told Keith, he'll be like, "Where the fuck are they?" Do you know what I mean?
Of course. So,
you know, it's kind of like. I had a bit more of a jovial sort of thing. I think I said to Ebrock on the phone, "All right, I'll play it twice for you then," and then hung up, and that was that. Whereas Keith was more angry about it, do you know what I mean? And I was just like, fuck him, you know, this is England, mate. Do you know what I mean?
We'll do what we want.
And the other funny thing was that I sampled them on that Fat of the Land album. They were on the album.
So that
made me laugh, really, in the background, you know.
It's kind of a crazy one. Well, I mean, I'll continue on. I haven't even asked how much time we've got. Are you in any rush,
or can we kind of go through?
Let's go through, because I wanted to. Obviously, we will get to the new record and tours on that. But I was like, that's right. As long as I can take my time. But
totally.
So around the time it kind of.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There you go. That was part one. As you will have heard, I got to the hour mark. Any regular listeners find it hilarious that I tend to mention when we're at the hour mark and wrap up. I don't know why. It's a fine thing to say. But yeah, you'll see that you will have heard that I was like, there's a lot more I want to talk about. Have you got a bit more time? So we went for 2 hours, essentially. So yeah, part two is up at midday. It might be up already, depending on when you're listening to this. Exciting times, guys. Let's just get on to part two. Oh, and again, if you want to join the Patreon crew to get a heads up, I mean, to be honest, I reckon if you've listened to all of this podcast in the hour or this first half, in the hour it's gone, the items have probably sold out. But me and Liam actually talk about the items or a version of the items at the end of the next podcast. So I'll see you in part two. Bye bye.
Hold up. Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.